This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Let me read to you a few headlines from today's newspapers. Saddam tracked to Tikrit, three American soldiers killed in day's attacks, writes USA Today. The front of the Washington Post reads, new Iraq proposal offered to UN. And the Los Angeles Times says, bomber kills seven in Iraqi capital. Saddam, the UN, a bombing. It seems what's most important about news in Iraq depends on where you read or see or hear it. The White House knows this, of course, and hasn't been happy with how networks and national media have been reporting on life in Iraq, or for that matter, on life in the U.S. economy, to combat what they see as a negative message. The administration yesterday granted a handful of broadcasting groups that own local affiliates one-on-one interviews with President Bush. No matter who's president, the White House and the national media always seem to be entwined in an artful tango. But every president seems to tire of the big-name dance partners in the White House press room and goes looking for other partners at some point in his administration. This hour, we're going to pull the curtain back a bit and talk about how the White House gets its message out and how the press presents that message to you. Join the conversation. Where do you get your White House news? From your local newspaper or TV? From a national source? From the Internet? How do you interpret what you hear? And what makes you trust a particular source? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us right now is one of the reporters who sat down with President Bush yesterday, Grant Rampe, senior correspondent with Tribune Broadcasting. He's here with us in Studio 3A. Welcome, Grant.
Afternoon.
How did Tribune get to be one of the five interviews?
We have been campaigning for this opportunity for years. Other administrations, we've gone to them, written letters saying, we have approximately 20 broadcast affiliates that you could reach in roughly one shot if you sit down with me or one of my colleagues. You're going to be able to have an entree into these markets everywhere from New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, all the way down to Hartford, Connecticut, Fox 61 News. Places like that where the president can go, speak to me for a few minutes, and we would be able to send out a story instead of talking to one anchor person, one reporter from one city. He gets 20 cities covered in one shot.
Mm-hmm. But you're not owned by any of the large networks.
Absolutely not.
You're a regional network owned by something called Tribune Broadcasting,
which is owned by the Chicago Tribune. Yes, we're small, but we're also large in the effect that one of the premier newspapers in the country owns a number of broadcast properties.
And you convinced the White House, finally, that they should come to you. That's why you believe they came to you and presented this interview?
Yes, but we also have to give the credit back to the White House in that apparently some of the younger aides realized that they had this resource out there that they could tap that had not been tapped before. The White House has wisely called in some of the anchor people from our stations, and for instance, one of the anchor women from Chicago made a trip in during the Clinton presidency, and they brought her in, and she got to sit down with him for a few minutes. Back on the plane she goes, and she gets a nice interview. But some of the aides realize that they've got Tribune Broadcasting out there, Belo, Sinclair, some of these names that people aren't familiar with, and by addressing them, they brought the five reporters in from these five larger companies, and they covered a grand swath of the United States, these local markets at roughly 10 o'clock at night, with the president's message undiluted by the larger networks.
Mm-hmm. And each of these locals, each of these stations and the local audience basically presents you as their person in Washington.
Yes, which I am.
Mm-hmm.
I do belong to Fox 61 and provide them content and WGN at Chicago very personally, although it's for the larger company. I am their guy.
Were you surprised when you got the call from the White House press office?
Just about fell over.
You did?
Oh, yeah. I was in Los Angeles at the time in my hotel room. A guy I work with, Tom, calls me up, tells me he doesn't tell me to sit down first. I'm sitting out the window looking at the Universal Studios, enjoying the morning, having some coffee, and he says, Grant, the White House called, and you'll be able to, this is a Thursday, you'll be able to speak to the president Monday morning. I knew he wasn't joking, it sounded serious, but I thought, this is amazing. So I had 5 days for the loose sleep, talk to my parents, call everyone I know asking, you know, please, you got to keep me in mind. I'm dying here. I get to talk to the president. So big deal.
So set the scene for us. Where was the interview? What happened just before the interview? Who else was in the room?
They also relied on some of our brethren within these companies. My team, my technical crew handled lighting. Hearst Argyle provided, I believe, the photographers. And then we had one or two White House technical people overseeing it, and a few of these younger staffers shepherding us in. And we were brought to the White House at a little after 8 o'clock, met. We had been told ahead of time that the White House was asking us to focus on the economy, Iraq, and the war on terror. Limit it to that, please. And we each had 8 minutes apiece. So then we waited around, and promptly the president was there at 9 o'clock, as we were told he would be. And we each took a turn, 8 minutes apiece, being led into the library room in the on the east lower side of the White House, where everything was set up. He sat down, and off we went, one at a time, individually, led in, got to talk to the president. We were let out.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you saw in the Washington Post today the article on this effort by the White House. You didn't. Well, let me quote someone from you. ABC's Mark Halperin said today, talking about this White House offensive, trying to go around the national media to the regional media, he suggested basically that it might be a little easier for the White House because regional reporters might be a bit more starstruck, maybe a little less prepared. How would you respond to that kind of criticism?
I don't appreciate it much, and I would guess if he spent 2 minutes with any one of us, he would retract that. We're as professional as he is, at times, if not more so. Starstruck, yes. But there's a job to be done, and you spend some time thinking about. We didn't agonize, but we definitely talked among my superiors about the questions that we needed to focus on to A, be respectful, B, learn as much as we could, advance the stories that we were potentially going to be talking about, Iraq, etc., but also work within our time limits, and I believe we professionally accomplished that without lobbing him softballs to please him and make sure we had an entree back to say, oh, Mr. President, the economy's going well, isn't it? We weren't about to say that. And I believe from the news content you've no doubt read in the Associated Press, the networks glommed on, especially Tribune Broadcasting's material, that we broke news.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Halperin is, I think, dead wrong when he says that, you know, this is not a bunch of kids that got an invitation to the White House, and we just fell all over ourselves and gave the president everything he wanted.
Mm-hmm. You're based in Washington, right? You're a Washington-based reporter.
Indeed.
Yeah, and you've been around, you've been in the business here for some time?
Been in Washington for 4 years, in Chicago on and off for 3 or 4 before that, and then broad cross-section of the country working my way up as a young guy.
Mm-hmm. And so tell us, how was your interview distributed? You did a local stand-up for each one of the stations?
Indeed. We went out, spent a lot of time crafting the 2-minute, 6-second story that came from our 8 minutes of time with the president. Crafted that on tape, put a lot of time into it, and then, yes, went to the White House property at a little before 10 o'clock, and that's when our station's on the East Coast at 10. We've got a few in the Midwest at 11, and then in the Eastern hour at 1 a.m., it's 10 o'clock L.A. time, and we've got 4 stations in that time zone. And then we proceeded to deliver in a very customized way that story to those markets.
Mm-hmm. So you had a long day yesterday.
It was almost 22 hours. But, you know, bring it on.
Right, right. You mentioned you broke news. What do you believe was the news that you got out of that interview with the president?
That the president very forcefully said that his critics, who have said things may not be going very well in Iraq, that the administration policy is adrift, he said twice, repeatedly and quite forcefully with us, they are dead wrong. And critics may disagree with some of his assessments, but the president did get to make that and get that message out. And there were also issues about the economy that he got to straighten out. One of the things that also made news, I heard NBC picking up on this morning, that the president had said, hey, there are some people who may disagree with me. I'm doing things in a big way. These are broad things. And if the American people decide come election day that they don't like the job I'm doing, they can replace me. Very interesting that he says nonchalantly, I'm here to do a job, not to get reelected.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your interview was any different than an interview that might have been done by Dan Rather or a reporter from White House reporter from The New York Times?
No, and to the end of Mr. Halperin's comments, I would say absolutely not. I've seen those interviews and frankly have dreamed of being in the position of doing them. So I was quite thrilled that when push came to shove and I got the opportunity to sit down, and my colleagues as well, the questions were broad-based and informative, I thought, and the news that we got from the president was worthwhile. Again, these were not softballs that we were tossing him because he let us in the room.
You've been listening to Grant Rampe, a senior correspondent with Tribune Broadcasting, who had a one-on-one interview with the president yesterday at the White House. He's here with us in Studio 3A. Also joining us in Studio 3A is Tom Rosensteel, a longtime reporter who now directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Welcome, Tom.
Good to be here.
In the Washington Post today, the White House Communications Director Dan Bartlett is quoted as saying, "We believe local media and regional broadcasters are more interested in letting viewers or readers see or hear what the president has to say. It's less analytical and more reporting." Is that true in your opinion?
Not necessarily. Generally, television stories on local news tend to be shorter, but they're not necessarily less analytical. What may be the case is that they wouldn't be followed by a second piece by the political strategy correspondent, or chief political correspondent, about why the president was granting this interview and something like that. That second piece might be more analytical, but the notion that somehow a network piece is going to be mostly correspondent and analysts, and that the president's voice wouldn't be heard is not only not true, but the president doesn't grant interviews to network news very often, so he doesn't really have a lot of basis for saying that.
How about what Mark Halperin of ABC News suggested, that somehow regional or local reporters might be a little less tough on the president, a little less prepared to do the interview? Would you agree with that?
Well, this is nothing new, by the way, the strategy of bypassing the networks. And there are two primary reasons that White Houses do that. One is that there's a lot of research that shows that viewers feel more connection to their local station than they do to networks. That during campaigns, Bill Clinton talked about how he could get more bang for his buck by talking to a local anchorman, and if he could win over the local anchorman or win over viewers on that show, it would mean more politically. The second reason is not that local news people are less intelligent or sophisticated, but this isn't their only job. Grant is in Washington and is a general political correspondent, but he's not at the White House every day. And so it is true that local correspondents are less specialized. To the extent that that gives somebody an edge, that they might be somewhat more starstruck. But I really don't think I don't think you're gaining as much advantage from that as you are the idea that you're connecting directly to the people by going to their local station that they have an affinity for or feel that they are connected to.
We're talking about where you get your White House news, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. Send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. We're talking about how you get your White House news, and in the studio with us is Tom Rosensteel, a longtime reporter who now directs something called the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Also joining us by phone is David Gergen, former White House advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He was President Reagan's director of communications. He is a director for the Center of Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and he's on the phone from us with us from Boston. Welcome, Mr. Gergen.
Hello, John Scott. So good to be here with Tom Rosensteel.
Hey, Dave.
Hey.
We wanted to get a perspective from someone working inside the White House and who's worked inside the White House. That's why we've come to you. What is President Bush up to right now, circumventing the national media? As Tom Rosensteel said, it's really not new, is it?
It's not new. It does represent something new in this White House, and that is a deepening frustration with the National Press Corps. For a long period of time, I would argue from essentially September 11th until May 1 of this year, the president received a generally positive press, and to an extent that some people thought it was press was way too deferential, because he in the rally round effect and rallying around his status as commander in chief, press I think gave him a hugely balanced to positive approach. But since May 1, I think the coverage has turned a good deal more negative, both toward him and his policies and in Iraq, and there's a frustration there at the White House, and this is one of the ways they're trying to address the frustration and the decline and public support for the policies in Iraq.
Well, it's my recollection that back during President Reagan's two terms, there were also efforts occasionally to bypass the National Press Corps.
Yeah.
Did they work, and will this one work?
It doesn't work over the long term. It can help, and President Reagan did do that. President Clinton, when he first came in, you may remember, there was a lot of talk then and an effort to go around the National Press Corps because of all the frustrations he had experienced during the campaign. Ultimately, it doesn't work, and while there's nothing wrong with it, and in fact there's much to be appreciated about the president and the White House speaking to the regional press and speaking to radio stations, I think that's all to be applauded. What has been missing here, and I think one of the reasons they've got problems, is that they're not communicating with any frequency or openness to the National Press Corps. They've been tended to run a pretty closed shop. It's been highly disciplined, but very closed by the standards of a recent president. The number of press conferences has been precious few, and the number of interviews, sit-down interviews with on a one-on-one basis with major news organizations has been even rarer. So much so, Tom could correct me on this, but I believe the New York Times has not yet had a one-on-one interview with this president. The Washington Post has been shut out. Dana Milbank is the reporter for the Washington Post is seen as a... So that, you know, I think part of their problem is it's one thing to communicate with the regional press corps, and that's terrific, but you should also, in my judgment, history shows, far better to run an open White House and take the lumps that sometimes come with that than to run a closed White House and invite the wrath of the press, which I think they've done.
Mm-hmm. David Gergen, stay with us. We want to get our listeners involved. We're going to go to Michael in San Francisco. Michael, you have a question.
Yes, I do. I wonder if the Tribune Broadcasting fellow is still there.
You know, he is not.
I've got a comment to leave. Then, and it was going to be a question. I don't think there's anything wrong whatsoever about going to the local media. They deserve to talk to the president, too. It'd be nice if he did spend more time with all the media. But my comment is that the president's and the administration's intent, a stated intent, was to avoid what they called filters. And it seems like they, in order to accomplish this, they handpicked certain journalists. And I wonder what that says about them as journalists. It seems, if you just follow it logically, that they're going to journalists that will not be filters. And my understanding of journalism is that it's supposed to be a filter because they filter out the PR. If they're doing their job, they filter out the PR and they filter out the BS. Now, this fellow said that he advanced the story, and the only thing he could come up with was that Bush said his critics were dead wrong. Well, number one, that's not a big surprise. And number two, the president has a chance to say that over and over and over again. So I don't see what the added value was. And it just seems that I'm sure he was very excited to talk to the president, but I think that these local reporters were used as basically as an extension of White House public relations, and they weren't doing their jobs as journalists.
Let's ask our guest to comment on that. David Gergen, when you were in the Reagan White House, did you look for softball reporters that you could get interviews with the president or other top administration officials?
Sure, and every White House has done that. That's a time-honored part of trying to get your story out in the White House. The real issue is not whether people do that. The issue is whether you answer tough questions on a regular basis from people who are assigned to cover you in a professional way. And the reason it's so important and the reason openness is so important, and we have a form of government in which, unlike a parliamentary system where a prime minister has to be accountable to the parliament and members of the prime minister's cabinet have to be accountable to parliament, but the prime minister has to go in for questions and answers regularly in front of a parliament. In our system, we don't have that, and what we substitute for it is the press asking questions, and accountability is through the press. It's not a question of the press being a filter. It's a question of whether the president and the White House are going to be accountable to the people for the extraordinary power that is entrusted to them through an elective process. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so necessary that it become a regular part of White House life. And our best presidents, go back to Franklin Roosevelt, he had a war on his hands, and he held press conferences on average twice a week throughout his presidency. Right through the Depression, right through the war, nobody had more overwhelming problems than Roosevelt, and by the way, it also served him politically because the people did feel more connected to him. Were the press a filter in those days? Of course, but there was also the larger question was one of accountability.
Mm-hmm. Tom Rosenstiel, is the press a filter, and if so, what kind of filter?
Sure, the press is a filter. The job of a politician is to advance their policies. The job of a journalist is to answer questions that it believes the public needs answered. And so, as the caller suggested, what journalists do is filter out the things that they feel are not of public interest and try and focus on the things that are. There is a natural tension between what policymakers are trying to do and what journalists are trying to do, and presumably in that tension the public gets the information that it needs. I'd like to add one other thing to what Michael in San Francisco said, and it's probably somewhat unfair to say that these news organizations were selected because they were targeting individuals who would be soft or friendly to the administration. I think if you look at the list of companies, they picked regional companies that are in the top 15 of size, Belo, Argyle, Tribune. They're quality companies, but they collectively reach a majority of the American population with the markets that they have stations in. And I suspect that more than hand-picking these reporters. I have no evidence that they even decided at the White House who these reporters would be.
Michael, in San Francisco, thanks very much for a good question and comment. Let me ask you, Tom Rosenstiel, you've done polls for your group about whether the media public, public trusts the local media or the national media more. What have you found out?
Well, and David knows this as well, there is a kind of hierarchy. People first trust local television news most, network television news second, local newspapers third in that hierarchy, and national newspapers last. I think there's two things going on here in these polls, and they've been this way for many years. One is that seeing is believing, that people have a relationship with the news people who they can see on television. And the second is that things that are more local are more trusted, in much the same way that people dislike Congress but like their local congressman.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Jesse in Philadelphia. You're on the air. Do you have a question?
I had a question. First of all, thanks for taking my call. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry, I don't have my radio on, so it's kind of disoriented.
Yeah, we're here.
I'm just curious what the impact, or what the people on your panel think is the impact of having the sort of cable news format taken over the way a lot of people get our news, and having I've always been interested in the impact of having the perpetual headline, such as the war on terror beneath like every single Fox News broadcast. There's the war on terror glaring beneath the screen, is the perpetual headline, be it when we're in Iraq or in Afghanistan or whether we're talking about a suicide bombing in Palestine or wherever. And I've always felt that it's somewhat misleading and it's somewhat a simplification of events, and yet that's sort of become the status quo in cable news, is the simplification and the soundbite type mentality. And I'm just curious on whether the callers would like to comment on whether they find that to be a problem, or whether that's just the natural progression of the media.
Thank you, Jesse. Actually, let me add something to that. David Gergen, it's curious about when the things turned around for the Bush administration. You mentioned May 1st. Is it, as Jesse said, because we constantly see these banners talking about the war in Iraq? It's never ending. It's always there. Is it the constant news coverage of the cable era? Or is it something that happened on or around May 1st that has turned the press against President Bush?
Well, I think it's important to remember at all times that facts on the ground can overwhelm words from the White House, and indeed even pictures from the television or newspaper stories. I mean, the truth is what happened after May 1 was people thought the war was over. And then we had a series of Americans who continued to be killed, and we've had now a series of bombings that are continuing to rattle Baghdad and the surrounding area. And those are stories. Those are riveting, important stories, legitimate stories. And no matter what rhetoric comes out of the White House about great progress, that's going to compete against the facts on the ground. I do think that the administration was caught by surprise by the way the press began to focus in on the harshness of what was happening, and they've not been aggressive enough in the last few weeks about putting out what the things are happening, in fact, that are more positive. You know, just as the bombings go on, there are 1,500 schools that have opened up through American troops, and that the American people deserve to know that. So I think the administration has been wise to go on the offensive to get more of that story out. But you can't get around the fact, you know, the facts are stubborn things, and the facts on the ground about the treacherous quality of living in Baghdad today with these bombs going off is just a story you can't walk away from. It's like the story of the Israelis fighting with the Palestinians. I mean, there's just a lot of violence. And I think the press naturally is going to write about that. And I don't think that's a question of the press just turning harsh. That's the reality we face.
Thanks very much, David Gergen.
Okay.
We appreciate your joining us this afternoon.
Okay. You're in good hands there with Tom. Thanks a lot. Bye.
David Gergen was a White House advisor for Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now director for the Center of Public Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he spoke with us from Boston. You're listening to Talk to the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now on the line is William Kristol. He was chief of staff for Vice President Dan Quayle during the first Bush administration. He's also an editor, or he's now editor, of the Washington-based political magazine, The Weekly Standard. He joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Well, do you agree with President Bush that there is a news filter that's interfering with him getting his straight story to the public?
Well, to some degree, I guess I agree more with David Gergen, just listening to him. Facts on the ground, Trump, words from the White House, and the big story of the last few months is the administration messed up to some degree. The post-war planning and for Iraq, the landing on the aircraft carrier on May 1st was, in retrospect at least, extremely ill-considered, and certainly the banner mission accomplished promised something that that they weren't able to promise. And people, understandably, got very nervous about what was going to happen in Iraq, began rethinking the war itself. Obviously, the WMD issue didn't help. And so I think that's mostly what's happened. I generally am skeptical when politicians blame the media too much, give too much credit, when enemies or opponents give too much credit to the media. You know, conservatives spent the 80s, I'm always struck by this, conservatives spent the 80s, and I was in conservative administrations and White Houses, bitterly complaining about the main networks and the New York Times and NPR to some degree. And, of course, Reagan won two big election victories, and Bush won after him in 1988. Rush Limbaugh comes along, Fox News comes along, there's much more balance, and the liberals are bitterly complaining about Rush Limbaugh and Fox News. And meanwhile, in the elections in the 90s, the Democrats won the popular vote three times in a row. So I think reality tends to trump, you know, whatever media bias or media filters there is.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you wrote a recent article in your magazine titled Civil War Within the White House. It was about a war within the White House over Iraq policy.
Right.
Of course, the president wants us to believe that there's no disarray and that he's in charge. I guess you're part of the filter, too, then, from the White House's perspective.
I got derated for this, as one always does by the Bush White House, if one ever suggests that anything got messed up or they didn't anticipate everything or there's some differences of opinion. It's a very thin-skinned White House, and I suppose that comes from the top. I think foolishly so. People wouldn't blame the president for not anticipating every possible thing that could go wrong in post-war Iraq, and they wouldn't blame him for saying, look, these were our working assumptions. Some of them turned out to be off, so we're correcting, we're having a course correction here. And in fact, that's what they've done, and I think actually they've benefited from that. I mean, despite their own PR, in a sense, people have, if you look at the polls, it's been a little uptick for Bush in the last week or so. And I think there's a sense of, you know what, he's stepping up to the plate. He asked for the money from Congress. He's got reorganized things within the government somewhat. Condi Rice is in charge, and he seems like he's got a better handle on what's happening. He's not denying reality. And I would praise them, incidentally, for their ability to react to what's happening and for being willing to make a mid-course adjustment. They'll never acknowledge that they've made such an adjustment. I mean, we're all sensitive to that, I suppose. We all pretend that, you know, everything is going the way we want it to go. But this White House may be a little more than most.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about this strategy of going to regional and local press? Is it going to work? Is it going to be helpful in any way?
I think on the margin. I think in, you know, that's a traditional strategy. I was in the first Bush White House where they tried it. It didn't do much good. Clinton was actually pretty good at that. But again, I mean, facts on the ground will trump. But I do think this White House has been, and they're very disciplined on their media message. They're not very imaginative in getting their stuff out. I was talking with a cabinet secretary actually the other day and said, you're a bright guy, you're an articulate guy, why aren't you ever on TV? I mean, why aren't you on cable TV at least? You're not going to get on the network news. These are the second-tier cabinet agency, and post-9/11, no one's thrilled, you know, they're not at the top of the headlines. But I remember in the Clinton years, you know, you'd turn on the cable news or NPR, these kinds of things. They don't have 50 million people watching at once, but they certainly have millions. And it's a political elite. And you'd see Donna Shalala, let's say, in the Clinton years, explaining how Clinton was bringing more health care to poor kids. Or you'd see former Governor Riley of South Carolina explaining how the Clinton education policy was working. Or Andrew Cuomo from HUD. And none of those was the most important issue of the day. And it probably didn't make a huge difference. But I think one had the general impression that, gee, they seem to have kind of an active, competent cabinet in domestic policy. You don't hear from the people in the Bush cabinet, even though they're pretty competent.
Bill Kristol, stay with us. We're going to take a break here. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about how you get your White House news here on Talk of the Nation and about the Bush administration's attempt to bypass the national media to get its message out. With us on the phone is William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, and here in Studio 3A, Tom Rosensteel, a longtime reporter now. He directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Tom, we've got an email here from Karen in Germany, and she says, if President Bush has a message for the nation, why does he not address the nation directly? A direct address would seem appropriate for President Bush's opinion. What reporters state should reflect the facts of the situation in Iraq and not a presidential opinion. What about the president going on the air and speaking directly or more news conferences, as David Gergen and Bill Crystal seem to be suggesting?
Well, I think that the medium that you use to deliver a message depends on the message you have to deliver, and the president has complained about filters. But in fact, a message, a purely political message of the sort that he's trying to make in these interviews, goes down better if it's done through reporters. If the president gets up to make a purely political remark and to complain particularly about press coverage in a national address, it may not be covered because the networks will say, well, this isn't really the president speaking to the public. This is the president, the politician. And I think the public would react the same way. So there's a certain irony here. The other thing is, a point I think worth making, is that this is a White House that doesn't talk about strategy and doesn't say, this is our PR campaign that we're going to do for the next 3 weeks. They've been quite disciplined about that. The fact that in this case they have done that suggests that part of this message is aimed at angry people on their in their base who are saying, why don't you do something about this? You're not doing anything. You're just sitting there. You've got to put a stop to it. And this is a way of saying, well, we have a strategy for putting a stop to it. So the message here is, the audience here is not entirely the public. It's also in part political activists.
Let's go to another caller, Brian in Salt Lake City. You have a question?
Scott McClelland is the new press secretary, and I was just wondering if he's just having growing pains or if this move by the White House has anything to do with him.
What would you say, Tom Rosensteel?
I don't think this is a kind of thing that they've got a bigger problem on Iraq, as David and Bill have both said, and I think the president has to step up to this. McClellan has been, you know, jousting about the press for on this issue for some time. Some problems require more than the press secretary.
Mm-hmm. Bill Crystal, do you think that the Bush White House just simply had it too easy over the couple of years since 9/11, when the press seemed to be giving it, as some critics suggested, a free ride?
No, I don't think so. I just think Bush did a pretty good job, frankly. And, I mean, or let's put it this way. Compared to expectations, Bush pretty consistently outperformed. We went into Afghanistan, lots of worries. The Russians have been bogged down there forever. It would be a very, very tough war. It went pretty well. Post-war, they didn't do such a great job, but good enough. It wasn't as if there were, you know, bombings and killings of Americans, and the place is presumably better than it was before when the Taliban ruled it, and safer for us. They didn't get Osama, but one had the sense of progress against al-Qaeda. In any case, there's been no major terrorist attack, and I knock on wood as I say this. I almost hate to say it because you think you're jinxing something. No major terrorist attack here, obviously, since September 11th, and not that much abroad, much less than most experts would have predicted. And then in Iraq, in the run-up to the war, a lot of controversy, but basically Bush went to the U.N. He didn't get the U.N. vote ultimately on the second resolution, but got enough to get cover and get some allies. The war itself went well. So basically, you know, Bush did well because Bush was doing pretty well, and then his liberal critics said things would go wrong, and they didn't go that badly wrong. And he was told he had to get involved in the Middle East and the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and he did get involved, and at least they made some progress for a while. That's now, unfortunately, not panned out particularly. And really what's happened in the last 4 or 5 months, and I say this as a, you know, unabashed supporter of Bush's foreign policy, but it's just a fact, is the world's gotten tougher and things haven't gone quite as well. That happens in life, and sure enough, people decide they're a little more doubtful about your foreign policy. And I very much agree with Tom. I mean, Scott McClellan, Ari Fleischer, these are all very much secondary things. The president could do a better job of making his case. I think he did go to the country. One of your callers asked about that. But, of course, he did speak to the country on national television just about a month ago. It didn't go particularly well. It wasn't thought to, at least, have gone particularly well at the time. I do think it's this administration, they've got to just keep making the case, but at the end of the day, it will be reality will trump everything. If a year from now, people can look back and say, look, that Iraq thing, you know, was a little dicey and tough, but at the end of the day, the country's better off, the Middle East is more promising, it was reasonable to go into Iraq as part of a broader war on terror, then Bush will be in good shape. But if it's a total mess and it looks like it's made the world less safe, and if it doesn't look like it was connected with the broader war on terror, Bush will be very badly penalized. And I think the best thing the administration could do is just go ahead and win the war and win the peace, really, and explain what they're doing in a little more systematic way than they've done. But they don't need to be very political about this. They don't need to criticize the Democratic presidential candidates, I think. And I don't really think they need to criticize the media. They can privately think of clever ways to go around some of the media outlets they're not terribly fond of. But I don't think it ever helps that much. Maybe it rallies supporters a little bit, as Tom suggested. But it's a mistake to get too...
Bill Kristol.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks very much. We appreciate your being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
William Kristol is the editor of the Weekly Standard, and Tom Rosenstiel directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Thanks very much, Tom, for coming to the studio today.
My pleasure.